107 Palestinians during the past day. Palestinian representatives slam Israel's policy of displacement, subjugation, and death as the ICJ holds a historic hearing on Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. And the Yemeni army says it has performed another retaliatory operation against a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, the Israeli regime continues to pound the Gaza Strip 136 days into the regime's onslaught on the Palestinian territory. 107 more Palestinians have been killed during the past day. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, the majority of the casualties have been civilians killed by Israeli airstrikes in the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala, including 30 people in the town of Al-Zawaida. Four more people were killed in Rafah from another Israeli airstrike, and in the south, 16 others were killed in the Khan Yunis area, where the Nasser Hospital is located. The hospital is severely damaged, and many of its staff members have been detained. Meanwhile, the Israeli artillery continues to bombard the eastern parts of Deir al-Bala. The Israeli genocidal war has so far killed more than 29,000 Palestinians and injured some 69,000 others.
Israeli regime is still committing atrocities against the besieged Gaza Strip with American-made weapons. Endless number of bombs has been raining on the Strip for more than four successive months, with Gaza's health sector admitting a tremendous number of the Palestinian casualties. One should take into account the Gaza medical infrastructure, which is devastated due to 17 years of siege and also the systematic Israeli attacks. That besides the delayed permissions issued for the injured Palestinians in need of traveling outside Gaza Strip has exacerbated the already catastrophic conditions.
We fled our house in Al-Buraiji camp to Deir al-Bala 40 days ago. We were targeted in the house for no reason. Many members of the family got killed over the attack. My father was among those injured. As you can see, he has severe burns all over his body. We're still waiting for the permission to travel abroad to get the needed medical care. We appeal to whoever is able to help us get permission for my father to travel. His condition is critical, and I don't want to lose him.
According to Gaza's health ministry, hundreds of injured Palestinians, including men, women, and children, lost their lives due to that delay, while thousands are facing imminent death due to serious wounds they sustained in Israeli attacks. Even those who managed to survive have one or more of their limbs amputated.
The number of the injured Palestinians is four times the capacity of hospitals, and this number is dramatically increasing over the constant Israeli airstrikes. We have at least 11,000 people injured in the Gaza Strip. Only in this hospital, 2,100 need an urgent permission to travel. The main obstacle is that receiving the approval for any case could take days or weeks. As a result, many might lose their life while waiting for the permission. We demand all relevant parties to set more effective mechanisms that help to rescue the people here.
It's noteworthy that the problem also includes the Palestinian patients with the chronic diseases and those in need of urgent surgeries.
I am Dr. Khaled Al-Saidni, working at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital since 2001. At the start of this aggression, I felt pain in my right leg. I found that my arteries were 80% blocked. Knowing that I'm a diabetic patient, my fellows told me that I needed an urgent permission to travel abroad to undergo a surgery before my health deteriorated and had my leg amputated. I have contacted and appealed all relevant parties to hasten the permission because time is really decisive. I have been waiting for the permission for about 2 months with no response.
Having a brush with the people inside any health facility in Gaza Strip is enough to wrench your heart when you see the injured children and their parents imploring for travel permission.
Now the question for the Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip remains unanswered, that who bears the responsibility for this delay that threatens the life of many injured Palestinians in Gaza Strip? Wati Abu Msabih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
A senior Hamas official says Israelis have a bad reputation for fulfilling their promises, calling on Palestinians to continue to resist against the occupying regime.
Israelis are not committed to their agreements and promises. They have a long history of not complying with what they agree upon. Palestinians' resistance against the Israeli occupation is the real guarantee for a potential deal, the one that was achieved during the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. The operation made Israel and the U.S. realize that the axis of resistance is able to exert pressure with the aim of supporting movements in Gaza and change the political equation in favor of the resistance front.
Hamdan said Palestinian resistance fighters have been inflicting losses on Israeli forces in Gaza every day. Hamdan added that the regime has failed to take back by force even a single Israeli captive held in Gaza. He noted that the U.S. is complicit in Israel's massacre of Palestinians. The Hamas representative in Beirut also underlined that resistance movements in Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq have exerted additional pressure on the Israeli regime and the U.S. Well, Brazil's president has slammed the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip as genocide and a war on women and children.
In the Gaza Strip, there is no war going on. It's a genocide. It's not a war between soldiers and soldiers. It's a war between a highly trained army and women and children.
Lula likened Israeli killings to the Nazi massacres during the Second World War. He also criticized the move by a number of rich countries to cut funding to the Gaza branch of the United Nations Relief Agency for Palestine. Lula questioned the political conscience of blocking UNRWA's funds. His comments increased pressure on Israel amid an international backlash over its planned ground assault in Rafah in southern Gaza Strip. The city is hosting over a million displaced Palestinians who have already fled there in a desperate search for safety. But Israel has intensified its airstrikes there in anticipation of a ground incursion. Meanwhile, the top UN court at The Hague has opened public hearings on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. Addressing the tribunal, Palestine's envoy to the UN said the international law has never protected Palestinians.
Israeli leaders no longer feel the need to hide their intentions. They speak openly of getting rid of the Palestinian people one way or another. They defy the law, and the law is barely fighting back. For Palestine, the law continues to be only a measure of the severity of breaches, rather than a catalyst for action and accountability. What does international law mean for Palestinian children in Gaza today? It has protected neither them nor their childhood. It has not protected their families or communities. It has not protected their lives or limbs, their hopes or homes.
Mansour said Palestinian people have faced attempts to push them out of their territories for 75 years. He demanded Palestine's occupation come to an end immediately and unconditionally. Meanwhile, the legal representative of the State of Palestine focused on the consequences of Israel's breaches of international law.
For almost 57 years, despite the repeated appeals of the General Assembly and the Security Council of the UN and numerous other international organizations, be they NGOs or governmental, Israel has obstinately stuck to its policy of oppression and discrimination against the Palestinian people in breach
of the most fundamental principles of international law, and by its practices has continually exacerbated the situation with the unconcealed objective of making impossible the realization of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination.
Over 50 states, including Iran, will participate in the oral proceedings before the International Court of Justice. At the request of the UN General Assembly, the ICJ will then issue a non-binding advisory opinion on the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. Last month, the court issued a provisional ruling in a case brought by South Africa against Israel. It called on Israel to cease all activities that could constitute genocide in Gaza. However, according to the UN Special Rapporteur, Israel appears to be in breach of that order. Well, during the hearings at the International Court of Justice, the Palestinian foreign minister said displacement, subjugation, and death are what Israel has offered Palestinians for decades.
The genocide underway in Gaza is a result of decades of impunity and inaction. Ending Israel's impunity is a moral, political, and legal imperative. Successive Israeli governments have given the Palestinian people only three options: displacement, subjugation, or death. These are the choices: ethnic cleansing, apartheid, or genocide. But our people are here to stay. They have a right to live in freedom and dignity in their ancestral land. They will not forsake their rights. I thus implore you, as you hear the legal arguments, not to forget the Palestinian people, not to forget that our people are struggling every day for their survival as individuals, families, communities, as a nation, that less than a month ago, this court ordered provisional measures in a landmark case brought by the Republic of South Africa against Israel under the Genocide Convention, an order that Israel continues to defy with impunity. For decades, Israel has occupied the Palestinian territory, committing violations that are inherent to its presence in our land and colonial objective. This occupation is annexationist and supremacist in nature. It is a deliberate, cynical perversion of international law. It is thus illegal. The only solution consistent with international law is for this illegal occupation to come to an immediate, unconditional, and total end. As you affirmed 20 years ago, the Palestinian people have the right to self-determination. It is an erga omnes right. It is non-negotiable, non-derogable. No occupying power, including Israel, can be granted a perpetual veto over the rights of the people it occupies.
Now, the Yemeni army says it has carried out yet another operation against a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. The army spokesman says the ship was seriously damaged after being hit with missiles in the Gulf of Aden. Yahya Saadi says the freighter, identified as Ruby Mar, has come to a complete halt and is on the verge of sinking. According to the spokesman, the safety of the vessel's crew is secured. The spokesman also said the army has shot down a hostile American MQ-9 drone in Hodeidah. Saadi said the army will continue operations against British and American vessels in response to attacks by the U.S. and the U.K. on Yemen and in solidarity with Palestinians. He said such operations will continue until Israel stops its onslaught on Gaza and ends the siege on the Palestinian territory. Well, our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul-Latif al-Washali, says the Yemeni people are urging the Arab country's army to intensify its operations in the Red Sea.
The Yemeni army has made it clear since day one that they will never stop attacking the ships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden until the siege and the war are stopped against the people. In Gaza, you know, the Yemeni army believes that the international community recognizes only the powerful one. They will not do anything for you unless you are powerful, you have force, you have an army, you can do something to harm the countries that are now just backing the Israelis and they're killing through the Palestinian people. The Yemeni army has enough experience with dealing with the airstrikes that are being carried out by the US and the UK. You know, they have been dealing with that for 9 years. You know, the US and UK have been backing the Saudi-led coalition, which was carrying out such airstrikes against the Yemeni army. They know how to deal with that. They are trying to stop the Yemeni army from hitting the ships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, but clearly they have failed. The Yemeni army has made it clear today, and they have, I believe, released footage for the ship that is being now, that is sinking now in the Gulf of Aden. So their attacks will absolutely fail. The only way to stop the Yemeni army's operations in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden is to stop the killing of people and women and children in Gaza and also now in Rafah. The people in Yemen are urging the Yemeni army to intensify, to escalate its operations, as the Israelis are now attacking Rafah and escalating their military operations in Palestine.
Well, Iran's foreign minister has left Tehran for Sri Lanka for meetings with high-ranking officials of the South Asian country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian is paying the visit to Colombo at the invitation of his Sri Lankan counterpart, Ali Sabri. In social media posts prior to his departure, Amir Abdullahian said boosting bilateral ties across various sectors, including trade, economy, and technology, topped the agenda of the visit. He also met with the ambassador of Sri Lanka to Tehran. Well, Iran says the Israeli genocide in Gaza has exposed the falsehood of the claims of such countries as the U.S. about advocating human rights. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the U.S. is the main accomplice in the genocide, as Israel would not be able to continue its crimes without Washington's support. Nasser Kanani says the U.S. is even willing to use its veto power to block any move by the U.N. Security Council to stop the genocide. Kanani made the comments in his weekly presser. He also touched on the upcoming hearing of the International Court of Justice on the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The spokesman said the court's ability to perform its duties is being tested in the case. Breaking news there from Lebanon. Hezbollah has targeted the Zionist positions in Kafar Shuba and in Berkerisha, occupied Sheba Farms with missile. Again, Hezbollah is retaliating by firing missiles to various areas. I'm sure we'll have more information on that in upcoming bulletins. So make sure you stay with us right here. Thanks so much for being with us for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The United States, Israel's biggest ally, has provided the Israeli regime with a raft of arms and ammunition since the war in Gaza started last October. The United States has also vetoed a number of UN Security Council resolutions that have called on the Israeli regime to cease its aggression in Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Wall Street Journal has covered this story and tells us more. The administration of US President Joe Biden is reportedly preparing to send tens of millions of dollars worth of bombs and weapons to the occupied Palestinian territories in continuation of Washington's untrammeled support for the occupying regime's months-long war in Gaza. Citing unnamed US officials, the Wall Street Journal reported on Friday, 16th of February, that the proposed arms delivery includes MK-82 bombs and KMU-572 Joint Direct Attack Munitions, or JDAMs, which add precision guidance to bombs, and FMU-139 bomb fuses. The report cited an assessment of the proposed arms transfer drafted by the U.S. Embassy in the occupied city of Al-Quds as claiming that the Israeli regime had requested rapid acquisition of these items for its continuing war in the Gaza Strip. Citing a U.S. official who said the details of the proposal could change before the White House notifies congressional committee leaders who would need to approve the transfer, the American Journal added, the proposed delivery is still being internally reviewed by the Biden administration. Since December of 2023, Washington has twice skipped congressional review of weapons sale to the Israeli regime, as the regime's brutal aggression against Palestinians of Gaza lingers on for more than 4 months, with well over 100,000 Palestinians dead and injured. According to the U.S. Journal, President Biden has provided roughly 21,000 precision-guided munitions to the Israeli regime since the start of the war last October. The report said the remaining weapons are enough to sustain 19 weeks of bombing Gaza, but that would shrink to days if Tel Aviv also launches a full assault on Lebanon, from which the regime has come under harsh retaliatory attack by the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. The arms transfer comes as President Biden claimed on Friday, 16th of February, to have been repeatedly pushed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza. In defiance of widespread international calls, the Israeli regime has insisted on an imminent launch of a ground invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza Strip. Rafah houses an estimated 1.4 million Palestinian refugees. Out of a total of 2.3 million population of the Gaza Strip, the United States, Israel's biggest ally, has provided the Israeli regime with a raft of arms and ammunition since the war started in Gaza last October. The U.S. has also vetoed a number of UN Security Council resolutions which called on the Israeli regime to cease its aggression in Gaza. The Intercept has also covered the same story and tells us more. U.S. Campaign for Palestinians' Rights in a report stated that every year the U.S. government writes Israel a blank check for at least $3.8 billion to fund Israel's violence against the Palestinian people. The U.S.-based pro-Palestine advocacy group, U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, stated, rather than using those funds to provide for American communities in need, our government uses taxpayer dollars to enable the Israeli military to massacre Palestinians, destroy their homes, and steal their native land. Code Pink, a women-led grassroots organization working to end U.S. wars and militarism, also recently issued a global call on the United States to stop funding the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The statement by Code Pink read, "The slaughter and daily assault on Palestinian human rights being carried out by Israel is an unacceptable use of U.S. taxpayer dollars. We demand an end to U.S. collaboration in the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians." The statement added, "U.S. taxpayers pay Israel over $10 million a day, and Israel uses that money to inflict violence all over Palestine. We call you to halt this aid and demand that Israel stop its assault on Gaza, its evictions from Eastern Al-Quds, and its attack on the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque." John Schwartz, writing in The Intercept, said he had been wondering how much money he, as an American citizen, contributed to Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories and attacks on the Gaza Strip. John Schwartz wrote, "So how much have I chipped in to create this hell on earth? The best answer I've come up with is $150, adding that it could be either less or more. John Schwartz added, "You can figure out your own contribution if you want. Add your income taxes to any federal bonds you bought this year and multiply that number by 0.004. According to a March report by the U.S. Congressional Research Service, Washington has sent Tel Aviv a total of $158 billion in bilateral assistance and missile funding since 1948. At the same time, the United States and several other Western countries have stopped their funding of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, precipitating a humanitarian crisis in the besieged Gaza Strip. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden sears his name in history by becoming the first sitting American president to be sued for complicity in genocide over the United States' abetment in the Israeli regime's ongoing genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. The first hearing in the case was held at the federal courthouse in Oakland, California recently. Human rights organizations and Palestinian U.S. citizens are plaintiffs in the lawsuit, which was lodged by the Center for Constitutional Rights, a New York-based legal advocacy organization, in mid-November. The Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit on behalf of Dr. Omar al-Najjar, a physician at Al-Nasser Medical Complex in the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip, as well as Palestinian human rights groups Defense for Children International, Palestine, and Al-Haq. The lawsuit also names U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The United States has been providing the Israeli regime with all-out military and political assistance. It has armed the Israeli regime with more than 10,000 tons of military hardware and blocked ratification of the United Nations Security Council resolutions that have called on the Israeli regime to cease its aggression in Gaza. The lawsuit states, "If the legal responsibility to prevent an unfolding genocide is to mean anything, indeed, if the rule of law is to signify anything, courts of law must have a role and responsibility to enforce these foundational international law principles. The lives of so many people are at stake."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. it's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Because we're waiting for a living imam, you've noticed all around, meaning in our community locally and globally, you see believers, mu'mineen and mu'minat, making effort to commemorate this event. So you have people reciting poetry, which is great. You have people hosting mu'mineen and mu'minat, absolutely important. We'll have some people reciting salam, ya Mahdi. That's also, we have to have these kind of things. The question is this: what's the most important thing we need to do for the imam to return? All of those are great, and we have to do those. But our question tonight to ask ourselves, and inshallah, the 3 points that we want to kind of focus on tonight will be with that outlook. What is it that the imam needs from us? You see, they teach us this: true intidhar, or waiting for the imam, means that you and I have to identify what are the traits that our imam needs us to have. For instance, our imam is going to establish justice. We have to be working towards that. Our imam needs ikhlas. We have to be working on our ikhlas, right? We have to be working on the traits that our imam needs then, now. We have to create the grounds, be those people who are ready for the imam by having the traits that the imam wants then, now. Meaning we have to create the grounds. That's on us. Having said that, our question that we want to ask ourselves is, what is it that the imam really needs? What is it that even if we are reciting dua nutba and we are crying our eyes out, we are offering food, gifts, these kind of things, but without this, the imam won't return. We're looking for that. So inshallah, we want to take 3 lessons, 3 reminders, of course, obviously, first for myself, but then for all of you, and then also to share with others, inshallah, in order to do our responsibility. So instead of us only looking to the imam today, last night, for dua for our needs, this time, what does he need from us? So brothers and sisters, we usually go over the ayat of the Quran together. I'm going to share one verse of the Quran about this perspective. What does God need? What does the imam need? And I'll ask brothers and sisters, as usual, to see if they can find this verse in the Quran or on your phones, and we'll read this verse together. Okay, so brothers and sisters, see if you can turn to Surah Baqarah and verse number 245. Let's see if I'm quoting this verse correctly. Remember the question, though. The question is, what does God need from us? Or in our case, what does the imam need from us? So let's read this verse together. We're looking at the Arabic, and then we'll read the translation together. God is asking, who is it? مَنْ ذَلَّذِي يُقْرِضُ اللَّهِ قَرْضًا حَسَنًا. Who is it who will give God a goodly loan? Right? How can we help? Who will give God a loan? If we do that, فَيُضَاعِفَهُ لَهُ عَضَاثًا كَثِيرًا. If you do that, then God will multiply what you do in His way multiple times. We're looking for the idea of what do I need to do for the imam? 3 lessons. The first lesson, well, I'm just going to kind of run over them and I'll see if I can cover all of them in 15 minutes and 45 seconds. Number one is connecting the dots. Why is it so necessary, if we're working for the zuhur of the imam, to connect the dots and talk about current events? Number one. Number two, what is the prophetic approach to the clarification jihad? I've talked before about the idea of the clarification jihad, the idea that you and I, we have one responsibility to first learn Islam, to embrace Islam, to implement Islam, but then after that, we also have a responsibility to spread the teachings of Islam as is in smaller circles. So the prophetic approach of our prophet when it comes to the clarification jihad. Number three, we're going to deconstruct one of the greatest obstacles to the return of the imam. For this one, I'm going to give the reference in the book so brothers and sisters can read ahead and find out what that greatest obstacle is. And then all of us collectively and individually will work on trying to deconstruct that biggest obstacle to the, one of the biggest obstacles to the return of the imam. So we'll start with the first one. The first one, brothers and sisters, is why is it so necessary when we have a religious gathering? We're here. We could just talk about the 12th imam. We could talk about when he was born. We could talk about who his mother was. We could talk about a lot of things. We wouldn't necessarily, we could have a session like this and not connect it to current events at all and go home and everybody would feel good. But what happened over here? Yes, Quds is a big thing. We have to prepare for Quds from now. We have to prepare our children for Quds. More than that, one other current event. Why is it that we would connect these events to the coming of the imam? Isn't it okay? Let's just talk about the imam and not bring anything current into it. Keep it clean. Part of the reason that people will tell us not to talk about these things is they say you've just got to be smart. Don't poke the bear. Just keep your nose clean. Don't talk about these kind of events. Quds, just keep your nose clean. Everybody knows our stance on Quds. Don't connect the dots. Don't speak up for the oppressed. Don't make it that the coming of the imam means you have to teach your children about Quds. Don't do that. Why? Because it's smart. You got to be smart. The problem with that, brothers and sisters, this is the first lesson for today. Brothers and sisters, I'll be absolutely honest with you. There is a price for resistance. Resistance, not rolling over, because people advise you, just roll over. Don't say anything. There is a price for resistance. But the price for surrender is a lot greater. So there's a price for surrender. There's also a price for resistance. But the price for surrender is a lot greater. And I want to give you some hadith about this. And then after that, some examples about this. And we'll move on to our next question. So we're answering, well, why is it that we have to mention that brother? Okay. Let's learn the principle now. This is from Imam Sadiq. So the Imam says this, "Man mana'a haqqan lillah." Whoever prevents, stops a right that God has. "Man mana'a haqqan lillah 'azza wa jal anfaqa fi batilin mithlay." This person will spend twice what they could have spent for haqq in batil. There's still a price. But it's more if you surrender. Hadith. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, a socket. So they advise us, be silent. Don't connect the dots, right? Imam Ali says, a socket. The person who's silent, akhuradi. When I'm neutral, when I don't take a side, I actually am taking a side. And I'm taking the side of the zalim. Right? Imam says this, وَمَنْ لَمْ يَكُمْ مَعَنَا كَانَ عَلَيْنَا. Those who aren't with us are against us.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The EU is a direct partner in the Zionist regime genocide in Gaza, and this is not a simple case of Western double standards. The Zionist regime sees Europe as a lackey, though Europe collectively carries significant economic weight. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Europe stayed silent when the Zionist regime began pounding the besieged Gaza Strip with a kind of ferocity that could only lead to a genocide. In fact, Europe remained silent when the word genocide quickly replaced the earlier reference to the Israeli-Hamas war starting on October 7th. Those familiar with Europe's political discourse and action regarding the Zionist regime and Palestine must already realize that most European governments have always been on the side of the fabricated regime of Israel. However, if this is entirely true, what can we make of the latest comments by the foreign policy chief of the European Union, Josep Borrell, when he seemed to lash out at Israel on January 23rd, accusing it of ceding aid for generations? During a joint press conference in Brussels with Egypt's foreign minister, Sameh Shoukry, and EU Commissioner for Enlargement, Oliver Varley, Borrell said that Israel cannot have the veto right to the self-determination of the Palestinian people. Borrell's frustration with Tel Aviv stems from the realization that Israel does not take Europe seriously. He's right. Tel Aviv regime never truly saw Brussels as a strong and relevant political actor in comparison to Washington or even London. Recent months have further exposed this unequal relationship. Soon after the Al-Aqsa flood operation, European leaders, starting with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, and French President Emmanuel Macron flocked to Tel Aviv, too. In the words of Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, reiterate that Israel has every right to defend itself. But European support exceeded that of language or political gestures. It also arrived in the form of military and intelligence support. Reuters reported, comparing the large sum to the 32 million euros worth of defense exports that were approved by Berlin in all of 2022, as of November 2nd, the German government has approved the export of close to 303 million euros worth of defense equipment to Israel. This is just one example.
While the Americans did not shy away from assuming the role of partner in the Gaza genocide, the EU's position seemed dishonest and, at best, morally inconsistent. Borrell initially approached the genocidal war from an entirely pro-Israeli perspective. He said, when asked in an interview last November whether Israel is committing war crimes in Gaza, "I am not a lawyer." A minute later, he asserted that Hamas al-Aqsa flood operation was undoubtedly a war crime. "This is not a simple case of Western double standards. The Zionist regime sees Europe as a lackey, though Europe collectively carries significant economic weight, which only in the case of the Zionist regime it refuses to translate into political leverage. Until Brussels learns to resolve this dichotomy, it will continue with this kind of bizarre foreign policy." One reason why the Zionist regime sees Europe as an inferior political actor compared to Washington is because the Europeans have linked much of their foreign policy agenda to the US, which in turn is motivated by Tel Aviv regime's agenda and interest. This is how it works. When Macron joined Biden in unconditionally supporting the Zionist regime in the beginning of the war, Netanyahu remarked that he was highly appreciative of the French position. But when, on November 11th, Macron dared criticize Israel's killing of women and babies in Gaza, Netanyahu immediately lashed out, accusing Macron of making a serious mistake, factually and morally. Slowly, Europe began developing a somewhat stronger position on Gaza, though certainly not strong enough to demand an end to the war or threaten consequences if the war does not end. On January 22nd, the EU held a ministerial meeting inviting the Zionist regime's foreign minister, Israel Katz, and Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyaz al-Maliki to attend. The conference was a feeble European attempt to signal the EU's readiness to assert itself as a relevant political actor in the West Asia region. The truth, however, is that the EU was motivated by other factors, including a green light from the Biden administration, which, as of late, has grown more frustrated with Netanyahu for refusing to engage in Washington's discourse about future visions and the two-state solution. Also, the regional instability, whether in the Red Sea or in Lebanon itself, a result of the war, continues to pose a direct risk to Europe's economic and strategic interest in the region. Europe's relationship with the West Asia region is in some ways different to that of Washington. While the US is always ready to reinvest its geopolitical priorities, Europe is indefinitely bound by the rules of physical proximity to the West Asia region, its vital geography, its resources, and its people. Europe knows this. Borrell, who devised the maxim that Europe is a garden, the rest of the world is a jungle, and the jungle could invade the garden, also understands that the instability in the West Asia region could endanger his precious garden even the war is over. This is why Borrell was keen on the EU's ministerial meeting, but instead of engaging in serious talks, the meeting further highlighted Europe's irrelevance, at least in the eyes of the Zionist regime. Katz had come to the meeting to present plans for an artificial island off the coast of Gaza, likely to displace Palestinians from the Strip, concepts that had nothing to do with the peace talks, Borrell said. Other top EU diplomats said the videos were part of old ideas presented by Katz in a previous role that they surprised everyone in the room. But the EU diplomats should not be surprised After all, their governments are the ones who have empowered the child killer regime of Israel. And this empowered Palestinians over 75 years. Even now, many of them continue to champion Israel's mass killings in Gaza as Tel Aviv regime's right to self-defense. If Borrell truly wishes to develop the political backbone, he should fully back international law and advocate for the use of the EU's massive economic leverage to put pressure on the child killer regime of Israel to end its war and military occupation of Palestine. Failing to do so gives great credibility to the claim that Brussels, just like Washington, is a direct partner in the Zionist regime's war on the Palestinian people.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019. Thanks to the revolution, Iran today stands out at an elevated position. Numerous young individuals brought up with a revolutionary spirit and ready to work for the sake of God and for the love of their country, and large numbers of intellectual and investigating young individuals who are in the job of creating scientific, cultural, industrial, and other types of products add up to the enormous wealth of the country that cannot be compared to any material reserves. In addition to the aforementioned assets, there is a long list of material opportunities for the country that can be activated and exploited by efficient, motivated, and intelligent managers in order to significantly increase domestic production and make the country self-sufficient, wealthy, and truly self-reliant, hence overcoming the current problems. Iran makes up 1% of the world population. However, it possesses 7% of the global natural resources. Massive underground resources, special geographical position between the East and the West, the North and the South, a major national market, vast regional market including 15 neighbors that constitute a population of 600 million, long coastal borders, fertile lands with a great variety of agricultural products, and vast and versatile economy are only some of the country's potentials. Many potentials have been left untapped.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It is said that Iran has the first place in the world in terms of unexploited natural and human resources. Without a doubt, you, the faithful and active young ones, can amend this great shortcoming. The second decade of the outlook must be dedicated to making use of the previous accomplishments and unexploited potentials, and the country's growth must be enhanced in different sectors, including production and national economy. My first advice concerns hopefulness and observing an optimistic outlook of the future. Without this fundamental key to any deadlock, not even one step can be taken forward. What I am referring to is authentic hope based on evident realities. I have always avoided false and deceiving hopefulness, but I have also warned myself and others against unfounded pessimism and false fear.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.